In these tremendous days in which we're living, the temptation to take every newspaper heading and try to relate it to prophecy. And in some cases, it is related to prophecy, and sometimes it isn't. During the last 6 months, we've had a tremendous worldwide experience. And the world has faced up for the first time to the fact that the Arab states control about two-thirds of the oil supplies of the world. And their potential has been illustrated and demonstrated, and they embargoed oil and cut down their supply of oil for the whole world with tremendous results in almost every nation of the world. It's, of course, doubled, tripled, quadrupled the price of oil. It wasn't too long ago that oil was selling for $1 a barrel. In the last 6 months, some oil was sold as high as $17 a barrel. You start figuring this out in terms of money that applies to us. At $1 a barrel, the gasoline you buy in its crude form only costs 3 cents a gallon. When it gets up to $17 a barrel, it costs 40 cents a gallon in its crude form. And obviously, in its refined form, it costs much more. And suddenly, while we knew it before, and some of our leaders have been warning us about this, we suddenly woke up to the fact that these Arab states, relatively small in political power and in population, have the power to disrupt the commerce and the economy of the entire world. Their action in cutting down the amount of oil available to the world, especially to the United States, has already changed the driving habits of millions of people. We've had to stand in line at gas stations, sometimes cancel trips because of difficulty in getting gasoline. It has crippled the economy of Japan, which is absolutely dependent on oil. Japan was in a state of tremendous growth economically. They were making tremendous profits in industry. And suddenly, with oil curtailed, all of this has come to a halt, and they're facing serious economic problems. Before the oil embargo, the world was paying the Arab states about $22 billion a year for oil. At the present prices, even at the limited production that is being attempted now, they will be paying the Arab states $100 billion a year. I'm not an economist, but it doesn't take very much imagination to see what this does to the world. Just for instance, suppose that they lifted the embargo on oil and began to ship oil to the United States as they did before the embargo. Do you realize that this would bring us into an annual deficit as far as payments outside our country in the amount of $13 billion a year? And of course, this amount of money would disrupt the whole economic balance of the United States and Europe, and with it the whole world. In fact, we can hardly get accurate figures as to how tremendous is the impact of this oil crisis on the world. As I was working on a book which will be published later this spring on Armageddon in the Middle East, it seemed to me that this oil crisis must have some dynamic relationship to the prophetic program. And as I worked on it, I became convinced that it adds the answer to certain questions about the prophetic program that we never were able to answer before. In order to make this clear to all of you, I want to paint a background picture, then deal with certain scriptures that describe the world government of the future, and then relate it to what we know concerning the Middle East situation. In my own understanding of prophecy, I of course believe that the rapture of the church is the next tremendous event. This is an event which could occur any day. It could occur tonight. And suddenly, without any further warning or signs or anything else, this wonderful event could take place. And Christians who have died will be resurrected from the grave. And living Christians will be translated, their bodies instantly changed. Together with those resurrected, they'll be caught up to meet the Lord in the air. And then we'll proceed in triumph to heaven. While they are enjoying heaven, tremendous events will follow in the earth. Now, it's rather obvious that if every Christian is suddenly and instantly taken from the earth, that it will have a dynamic effect upon the world as a whole. While we as Christians are a small minority, many Christians are in influential places, in government and in business. And their sudden disappearance will certainly have an effect on the world. The Bible does not comment on this, rather strangely. We don't find any passage that really comments on the world's reaction to the rapture of the church. Dr. H.A. Ironside, a great expositor of the past generation, used to say that he wished he could stay around a week or two after the rapture and attend some of the liberal churches to see what they would say about the rapture and what had happened to some of their most spiritual members. Well, this might be very interesting. But even without using our imagination and using such scriptures as we have, we know that there will be a tremendous effect on the world. And the things that are moving fast already today will move at an incredible pace once the rapture takes place. There are going to be developments all along the line. I believe immediately after the rapture, there is a brief period of time, the length of which we do not know, that I call the period of preparation. It's the final setting of the stage for events which will follow. And the Bible tells us some of these events. One of the events will be the opening of the eyes of Jews throughout the world. In Romans 11:25, we're told that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles become in. Now, the fullness of the Gentiles is an expression that refers to the present full blessing upon Gentiles in this present age. When Gentiles and Jews have an equal opportunity on the same basis to receive Christ as Savior and to be made one in Christ in the body of Christ. This is our wonderful privilege. This is a time of Gentile blessing. The Gentiles have been grafted into the olive tree, to use Paul's figure in Romans 11. And we have been greatly blessed. Now, once the rapture of the church takes place, this is all changed. And God begins to deal in a very special way, spiritually, with Israel. And I personally believe that thousands of Jews all over the world will turn to Christ. Many of them already have New Testaments. They use New Testaments as a textbook in the schools in Israel, so that every Israelite young person has had some contact with the New Testament. And of course, we'll leave behind our libraries and our Bible. I believe that many of them will have an insatiable curiosity to find out what happened to these Christians who suddenly disappeared. And as they read the scriptures, they'll find the answer. And they'll come to the realization that this Jesus of Nazareth, whom they thought was an imposter, is indeed their Savior and their Messiah and their Lord. And I believe thousands of Jews will come to Christ. They in turn will bring a witness to the world, to their fellow Jews and to Gentiles, and a new testimony will be formed, similar to that in the early church, when the gospel went forth to the whole world, and these new converts carry the tidings to those who have not heard. Now, politically, there's also going to be some rapid realignment. We believe that there will be in the Middle East a 10-nation group, which may be derived from the common market. I personally think that won't be directly what we have today in the common market. But a group of nations in the Mediterranean area will band together in a confederacy, and that out of this group will emerge a man who will become their leader. And he will have a dynamic effect in bringing together these 10 nations into a political group. And he will use his power to further the advance of the Middle East. Now, I think all of this is going to take place very quickly, in a few months, or at the best, a few years. The Bible doesn't tell us how long it'll take, but all the implications are that things will move very rapidly. Once this man is in power, he will introduce the second phase, the period of peace, and he will bring about a peace treaty, as we mentioned earlier today, between Israel and their neighbors. It will be a peace treaty, which is mentioned in Daniel 9:27. Apparently, though the details are not given in the Bible, apparently it will guarantee Israel's borders, assure them that they will not be attacked from without, and this political leader will use his power and his authority and his control of the situation to bring a measure of peace and stability to the Middle East situation. Now, when this period has gone on for 3.5 years, something dramatic happens. Bible scholars are not all agreed this is just what's going to happen, but one plausible solution is that Russia is going to fulfill the prophecies of Ezekiel 38 and 39 and attack Israel. In attacking Israel, they are in effect attacking the whole block of nations. They are in effect making a bid for control of the Middle East and all its wealth and all its geographic importance. They are making their bid for world power. Ezekiel 38 and 39 tells us that Russia is disastrously defeated, apparently by an act of God, and its armies are wiped out. And in the resulting confusion, the Middle East rises to supreme power, and its leader proclaims himself dictator over the entire world. It seems that prior to this time, that there was a balance of power in the world, politically, just as we have it today, between Russia and her friends on one side, and the rest of the world on the other. And with Russia temporarily out of the picture, it leaves this leader in the Middle East in a supreme place, and he proclaims himself dictator over the whole world. When he does this, he introduces a third period. We've had the period of preparation, a period of peace for 3.5 years, and then, now, a period of persecution, a period of trouble, the Great Tribulation, for another 3.5 years. In this period, the world government will come about. This man will take supreme power, politically, economically, and religiously. He's going to claim to be God. And as a result of his blasphemy and his persecution and martyrdom of countless believers in Jesus Christ, both Jews and Gentiles, God is going to pour out terrible judgments on the world, which are portrayed for us in the book of Revelation beginning in chapter 6. And most of the world's population apparently is wiped out in a series of great catastrophes and judgments from God. The world then will end up in a gigantic world war, a war that is brought about by dissatisfaction with the leadership of this dictator. The armies of the world will converge upon the Middle East to fight it out. Millions of men will be involved. And at the height of this war, before its issues are resolved, Jesus Christ will come back in power and glory to set up his kingdom over the entire world, his millennial kingdom, when Christ will reign supreme as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. It'll result, as we saw earlier, in the restoration of Israel to their promised land. It'll also bring blessing to the entire world. At the beginning of the millennium, all the unsaved are put to death. And only those who have trusted in Christ in those tragic years of the Great Tribulation before will be allowed to enter into the millennial kingdom. And so the climax is going to be the second coming of Christ and his return. Now there are many things about this prophecy and this sequence of events for which we do not have complete answers in the Bible. We have some information, however, that gives us some very definite facts. For instance, in the 7th chapter of Daniel, in verse 7, the fourth beast is represented. You'll recall that Daniel describes human history from his standpoint as embracing four great world empires. The first was the empire of Babylon, which captured Jerusalem when Daniel was a boy, and he lived under the sway of the Babylonian Empire most of his life. In 539 BC, the Medes and the Persians conquered Babylon, and the second empire of the Medes and the Persians came into power. About 200 years later, Alexander the Great, the king of Macedonia, brought in the Grecian Empire, and this went on for some time. Now, these are named in the book of Daniel. We don't have to guess about it because Daniel gives us the names of these three great empires. But the fourth is described as a great beast. It obviously relates to the Roman Empire, the greatest empire of all history, which began several hundred years before Christ and continued in one form or another for almost 1,500 years after Christ was born. It was in great power when Christ was on earth. Christ was crucified on the order of a Roman ruler. And all this is backed up in the Scriptures. In verse 7 of Daniel, of chapter 7, we read this: "After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. It had great iron teeth, it devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with its feet, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before." This is an accurate picture of the terrible cruelty of the Roman Empire. They would come into a country, carry off the able-bodied men as slaves, and literally ruin the countries in many cases. It was like a great beast with iron teeth that devoured and broke in pieces. But as you read on in this prophecy, it tells us in the last part of verse 7 that the beast had 10 horns. Now, there is nothing in history in the Roman Empire that corresponds to this. For we learn later on in this chapter, when Daniel is given the interpretation, that these 10 horns are 10 kings, and that they are kings that are reigning simultaneously. Verse 24, "The 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise." This, of course, seems to indicate what I mentioned earlier, that there is going to be a 10-nation group in the Middle East in the future. Then it tells us that as he considered these 10 horns, verse 8, "There came up among them another little horn, before which there were 3 of the first horns plucked up by the root. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things." This little horn is apparently this ruler in the Middle East of whom I spoke, who gains power first by conquering 3 countries, and apparently the other 7 capitulate because he ends up as the ruler of the entire confederacy. And we're told this in the interpretation, verse 24, "that the other, the little horn, shall rise after them. He shall be diverse from the first. He shall subdue 3 kings. He shall speak great words against the Most High." And it goes on to speak of how he is going to persecute the saints and how they're given into his hands for a time and times and half a time. This strange expression seems to refer to 3.5 years. A time is 1 unit. Times is plural. You add 1 plus 2 is 3, and then half a time makes it 3.5 years. Again and again in Scripture, we are told that this time of great tribulation is going to be 3.5 years, or as Revelation twice calls it, 42 months, or as Revelation 12 refers to it, as 1260 days. All of these add up to the same figure of 3.5 years. And this ruler is going to rule for 3.5 years until Christ returns. And then, as described in Revelation chapter 19, this ruler and the false prophet who's associated with him will be cast alive into the lake of fire. Now, as we turn to the 13th chapter of the book of Revelation, we find the counterpart of this in the New Testament. And time will not permit us to go into the details of this chapter, but it describes a beast out of the sea that has 7 heads and 10 horns. It obviously is a picture of the same entity that we saw in Daniel chapter 7. It goes on to describe this beast as having supreme power, as being empowered by Satan himself. It tells us in verse 4 that they worshiped the dragon, referring to Satan, who gave power unto the beast, referring to this ruler. And they worship the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" There was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemy, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. Again, the familiar 3.5 year figure. Then in verse 7, it indicates that it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. Verse 8 goes on to say how that all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, except for those who turn to Christ in that day. Now, in a preceding generation, these prophecies of a world government had some real problems. How could you, in any one spot on the earth, control the entire world? I think before our generation, it was physically impossible to do this. There have been great empires in the past. The Roman Empire was the greatest. Went from the River Euphrates, Western Asia, all the way to Great Britain, across Southern Europe, Northern Africa, including a great area of the world. But it fell far short of being a world empire in a realistic sense of the term. It had no control over the Western Hemisphere, which wasn't even known at the time. And until our day in the 20th century, there are real questions as to how anyone could ever control the entire world and control it in the way that this world ruler indicates. He has absolute control. He requires everybody to worship him at the pain of death. He has absolute control over the economy of the time. No one can buy or sell without his permission. And there are many puzzles as to how this could all come about. In the last 15 or 20 years, it's rather amazing how the components have fallen into place that helps us to understand how a world government can come about. First of all, since World War II, with the advent of the atomic bomb, there has been a worldwide recognition of the need for a world government, which is embodied today in the United Nations. Now, the United Nations is a weak instrument. It hasn't kept the world from war, but is a recognition of a principle. And the principle is that it's better for nations to give up their sovereignty and to discuss their problems on the conference table rather than try to settle them with an atomic war. And up till now, at least, an atomic war has been averted. We're living in a day that sees a need for a world government, and this has never been true before. But how could such a world government come about? Well, first of all, if you're going to have a world government, it's obvious you couldn't have it in sailboat days, when communications and transportation were incredibly slow. Today, we have these problems solved. In the fall of 1973, when Israel was practically out of ammunition and many of its tanks and planes had been destroyed, the United States, in just a few days, flew some $2 to $3 billion worth of military equipment from all over the world and brought it to Israel. And Russia did the same thing. Now, you see, this would have been impossible 25 years ago. You could not have moved this amount of material in the time that was needed 25 years ago. But today, with rapid transportation, things and men can be moved anywhere in the world in comparatively few hours. Then today, we have atomic weapons and we have missile warfare. For the first time in history, it's possible to press a button on one portion of the globe and send a missile, which could be armed with atomic weapons, to any other portion of the earth in about 30 minutes or less. This has never been true before. But what tremendous power it puts into the hands of a world ruler. If he controls atomic weapons and is able to threaten any area of the world that disobeys him or rebels with destruction of atomic proportions. Now, ultimately, the scriptures indicate that they rebel anyway. It's possible that atomic weapons are dismantled under the world government. But this is something brand new. Suddenly, today, one man has power such as no man has ever had in the history of the world before. And then when it comes to communication, it's most important for a world ruler to be able to communicate effectively. In a generation preceding, they perhaps had radio and telegraph. They could communicate. But today, we have television. It's possible for one man in one location to speak on television and be seen and heard all around the world. Now, this is a tremendous instrument in the hands of a world ruler who completely controls the media and can use it for his own end. And this, I believe, is another essential component in a world government. And then we have this statement that no one can buy or sell except he have the mark of the beast. Revelation 13:7. No man might buy or sell except he have the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. He has to be identified as a worshiper of the beast before he can buy or sell anywhere in the world. Now today, for the first time in the history of the world, due to the invention of computers, it's literally possible for the economy, for the money matters of the world, to be controlled by one man in one place. Now this has never been true before. We're all aware of the fact that we are being reduced to numbers. Our social security number, or our number on our checkbook, we have become numbers which computers can use and control. And for the first time in the history of the world, it's possible to put all the control of the money matters of the world into the hands of one man in one place. Something that has never been true until just very recently. And so one by one, we've seen the components of a world government fall into line. The questions answered that a generation ago we couldn't answer. How could one man control the world? How could one man communicate to the world? How could he transport men and things rapidly all over the world? And how could he control the world in its economy? But there is one question that has always puzzled me until the oil embargo took place last fall. And that was, how could we explain the rise of the Middle East to a place of supreme political and economic power? Anyone who has visited the Middle East soon becomes aware of the fact that Egypt and Israel and Syria and Lebanon in particular are living to a large extent on money that's poured in from the outside. We have been pouring in as much as $100 million a year into the economy of Egypt. We have been almost literally supporting Jordan. When I was over there some years ago, I asked them where they got the money to build some of their new buildings. They didn't answer me, because all the money was coming from the United States. And you see the tremendous building that's going on in Israel. Where has that money come from? Well, it hasn't all come from our government, because we've given Israel relatively little, except in terms of armament. But it has come from Jews in America who have contributed hundreds of millions of dollars to the economy of Israel. And the Middle East has literally been supported in large measure by money from the United States. But I couldn't understand how a country that is so miserably poor, in Jordan, until recently at least, the average income was about $250 per year, just barely above the starvation level. And you cannot help but be impressed with the poverty and the lack of advance in these nations that characterize much of the Middle East. And it always was a problem to me. How could the Middle East ever rise to power? How could a dictator in the Middle East come to political power where he could proclaim himself dictator over the whole world with no one to say no to him? And how could they have the wealth to control the economy of the world? There were some other puzzles that I could not understand. I know there are some that equate the United States with certain prophecies relating to Babylon. I personally feel that the United States of America is not mentioned in prophecy. And while we may have some influence on end time events, it's not specified in the Bible. It seems rather clear that our influence is going to go down rather than up as the end time moves on. It's also of interest that Russia's influence is going to go down. Russia today is doing all it can to support the Arab world in the hope of turning the Mediterranean into a Russian lake. They want the Suez Canal open so that their battleships can go through the Suez Canal and go down into the Indian Ocean and control Southern Asia from a military standpoint. And Russia's dreaming of extending its influence over the Middle East. Now, if there is anything that is clear in prophecy, it is that at the end time, Russia will not have power in the Middle East. The Middle East ruler who is going to rise up is going to be against Russia rather than for it. That's why Russia has to attack Israel, because they have not been able, by using other means, to gain control of the Middle East. And so we have these puzzles. If the Middle East does not gain its support from the United States and does not gain its support from Russia in the end time, where is its wealth going to come from? And now suddenly it all comes into focus. The Middle East has tremendous oil wealth. Two-thirds of the oil of the world, it's known, is found in the Middle East. And the Middle East nations, especially the Arab nations, have the power to wreck the economy of the whole world. This is rather a fascinating thing to contemplate. Saudi Arabia has only about 3 million people, about the same population as Israel. This is less than the population of New York City. And yet this little nation of Saudi Arabia, King Faisal, leading the way, has made it clear that they can blackmail the whole earth into doing what they want them to do. And because Holland would not give in, they cut off their oil to Holland. Now, Holland soon discovered it could get oil from other sources. But the other European nations are all cutting loose. They will not back the United States in a stand against the Arab world and a stand for the nation Israel. And so they're trying to make their own agreement with the Arab world, with devastating effects upon our whole U.S. policy in relationship to Europe. Kissinger the other day said that this was a major problem in international affairs today. Suddenly, in the course of just a few months, the whole situation has changed because of the power of the Middle East. Now, if they wished, they could cut off oil from Europe and bring Europe literally to utter economic chaos in less than a year. And do not think that we in the United States could stand on the sidelines and watch this go on without doing something about it. We would go down with them. And the result would be a tremendous economic collapse over the entire world. Now, fortunately, the Arab nations are frightened by this prospect. After all, they have tremendous investments in Europe and the United States. They are pouring billions of dollars into the United States right now with special relationships to the chemical industry. They're buying stock. They don't want us to go bankrupt. And this will be one good reason why eventually they may lift the embargo, at least in part. They don't want Europe to go bankrupt. But it's tremendous that they have the power to do it. You see, the Middle East today, poor as it may be in many respects, backward in its progress in manufacturing and other things, and living on a relatively low scale, economically, for most part, the Arab world. The Middle East today has the power that no group of nations has ever had before in the history of the world. And it suddenly begins to come into focus. The reason that the Middle East ruler is going to become a world ruler is because he will control the wealth of the world. Now, as you contemplate that for a minute, I'd like to put alongside this another fact. You know, sometimes we encounter people who say we're a little bit too alarmist in thinking that the signs point to the coming of the Lord soon. But after all, 1900 years have elapsed. There have been countless generations that pointed to signs in their period that they said indicated the Lord's return was near, and he didn't come. How do we know that we are not alarmists in our day? Well, I think if you examine the kind of signs we have today, they're entirely different than it ever existed before. They are not little things, they are big things, like the movement of the church into a world religion, the movement of the world towards a world government, and the solid fact that Israel is back in the land in precisely the situation you'd expect them to be if this were the time we're moving into the end time. And so we have some good solid facts. But here is something to contemplate. It's true that the Arab world has 2/3 of the oil deposits of the world. But did you notice something? Strange to say, when the oil embargo went in, the value of the dollar went up. Now, how can you explain that? Well, the newspapers explained it on the ground that we weren't spending as much money abroad. And suddenly the balance of payments was in our favor. Suddenly the dollar became the best currency in the world and became a valued object for financiers the world over. But you know, behind this was a sudden realization that of all the nations in the world, the United States and Canada are among the very few that will be able to stand against the Arab world. You see, we produce about 85% of our normal requirements for oil. It would be possible, by rationing gasoline and the use of oil, to limit our use within our own capacity to produce. It's also true that we have tremendous reserves that have been untapped off the coastline, the Atlantic coastline, off the Gulf, and off the coastline of California. There is measureless oil which has not been used, which has not been tapped, because of fear of hurting the ecology of those areas. But then, perhaps even more important, is the realization, for the first time, that we also have, in the states of Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah, the so-called Green River strata of oil shale. Now, this oil shale contains oil. The problem has been that the cost of manufacture has been prohibitive. It costs between $5 to $7 a barrel to produce this oil. And with oil selling for $1, $2, or $3 a barrel, it wasn't feasible to use these tremendous reserves. But do you know that in these three states alone, there are 600 billion barrels of oil available? This is more than all the total oil reserves of the world. It's there. Now there are great difficulties, because it had perhaps wrecked the beauty of these areas to mine this oil shale. It takes tremendous quantities of water. There will be great pollution problems, which they have not solved. But the facts are that the oil is there, enough to supply our United States at the present rate of use for 100 years. As these facts, which were known before, began to penetrate the world, the financial world, suddenly the world became aware of the fact that the United States wasn't too bad a risk economically after all. In spite of our problem, we after all had at least a partial solution to the oil problem of the world. But the problem is, it's going to take from 5 to 10 years to do it. And it's going to cost from $5 to $10 billion to develop the processes and the equipment to get this oil out of the ground and get it into use. But now I want you to add one other fact to this. We've mentioned that the Arab world has 2/3 of the oil reserves of the world today, that is, in liquid oil. But you realize that these supplies of oil in the Middle East, as far as our present predictions are concerned, are going to run out in 30 to 40 years. It wasn't too long ago that East Texas had 1/3 of the oil known reserves in the entire world. Today they are producing no oil in East Texas. They took the oil out of the ground, the water moved in, and it's a desolate field as far as oil is concerned. In 30 or 40 years, the Arab world will not have the power that it has today. This adds up to me, and to the Arab world, for they're fully aware of this, that now is their hour of power. And unless they use this power and use it to control the world according to their liking, they are going to lose this power in another generation. To me, it is another indication that the world is headed into its final confrontation. That the Middle East crisis is not going to be resolved until it's resolved in the biblical pattern. A Middle East ruler will arise. And eventually he will become a world ruler. And back of him will be the limitless power of the wealth of the Middle East, as it controls the economy of the world and is able to force all nations, with the possible exception of the United States, into following into its pattern and do according to its will. And when you add all this up together, it adds up to this, that the time is very short. There's never been an hour in history like this. There's never been a crisis in the world like this. There's never been a realignment of power in the world such as we've witnessed in the last 12 months. And to me, it's another indication that the stage is being set for the final drama. But before the final drama ever takes place, the rapture of the church is going to occur first. Perhaps we can liken it to a play. And the curtain is down. And behind the curtain there is the rumble as the props are put in place for the play. And then everything gets quiet. Because everything is in place that needs to be in place for the start of the drama. What are you waiting for? Why are you waiting for the curtain to go up? And for the drama to begin? I believe that's exactly where we are in the history of the church and the world tonight. The components are already there. The players, for the most part, are waiting their turn to do their act. The props are all in place. All the major elements that are necessary for the start of the drama are already there. All we're waiting for is the coming of the Lord for His church.